jobs lost. And the troubles of so-called legacy media have spread to digital-only sites. The prominent GigaOM failed in 2015, and Mashable and Salon were laying off staff in summer 2016. By December 2016, there were also staff cuts at Fusion, The Huffington Post, and International Business Times. In some ways, the new world of newspapers is far more efficient than it was in the centuries of print circulation. Especially in the United States, finding even high-circulation, out-of-town newspapers used to be a challenge even in the largest cities, if only because of the poor railroad infrastructure. Their British counterparts have such a strong national scope that in 2014, Amazon.co.uk contracted with the newspaper delivery agency Connect for fulfilling its own shipments. While many major U.S. newspapers now limit free access to articles, digital subscriptions cost a fraction of mail delivery. Electronic publication has also globalized reading habits. According to Pew Research Center's State of the News Media 2016, the electronic editions of the London Daily Mail and Guardian would rank them among the five most read newspapers in the U.S., The Telegraph and Independent in the top 10, and others from Australia, Canada, India, Ireland, and New Zealand in the top 50. Conversely, the New York Times had 30 million unique international visitors a month in February 2016, about 5% of them engaged readers, however the Times measures engagement. This global reach, in principle, offers new opportunities for advertising revenue and paid subscriptions, and for expanded international reporting when many overseas bureaus are closing. The efficiency of electronic publication is not limited to international distribution. It has also transformed journalists' relationship with their audience and each other. In the 1970s, the historian Robert Darnton, who had worked briefly as a reporter, cited the findings of the social scientists Itiel de Solapool and Erwin Schulman about newspaper writers and their audience. Journalists, the researchers had found, had little direct information about their readers' response to their work. Each imagined the reader to be like a friend or acquaintance, supportive or hostile. Reporters would slant their facts and interpretations toward these expected archetypes. Comments sections today allow much more concrete feedback, but so many are intemperate that moderating them becomes an additional expense. When Darnton was a reporter, the layout of the newspaper was a map, not only of information, but of the hierarchy of reporters and their assignments. On today's web pages, and especially on mobile devices, this organization is less clear. When we read the New York Times or the Washington Post on a smartphone and compare it with the layout of the print version, we gain the efficiency of compactness and scrolling. It is easier to save an article or post it to social media. But we also lose, for better or worse, our sense of what the paper's editors think about the importance of the day's stories and their relationship to each other. We're less likely to notice which reporter's bylines are above the fold if there's no fold. For young people whose main exposure to information is social media on smartphones, there may be less interest in the whole of a single publication. A growing proportion of news stories are read through referrals by search or social media, a grazing strategy. Yet if the base of subscribers, especially print subscribers, continues to erode, there may be less new and original content to refer. From the journalist's point of view, information on actual reader behavior is potentially a great step forward from writing for a hypothetical favorable or skeptical audience as described by Poole and Schulman. There can be valuable insights in measuring readers' time spent on an article and social media posts. There is encouraging anecdotal evidence that some newspapers have used such programs to improve content, especially paying attention to topics that don't interest most readers conventionally. One newspaper group in Alabama, for example, was able to pool the resources of three papers to launch a mainly online investigative report of abuses in the state's prisons, a topic readers are conventionally expected to ignore, but which led to over a 500,000 page views. Foundations are supporting such projects by newspapers and nonprofit journalism organizations. But there are three core problems in measurement. First, reader engagement metrics are proliferating, recalling the old joke about technical standards, that there are so many to choose from. Second, the proprietary metrics of Google, Facebook, and other advertising programs are both highly sophisticated and at least partly secret. So newspapers not only have to support their own engagement analyses, but to anticipate the ever-changing analyses of platform companies and other advertising providers. At least one major daily has a full-time staff person to guess the algorithms used by search engines and social media sites to recommend articles, so that writers and editors can choose topics and tweak style to maximize clicks. This takes resources from the actual work of reporting and writing. And third, reader studies can be inconclusive. Treatment that pleases one segment of readers may bore another. Excessive concern with short-term popularity discourages journalism that recognizes issues early and makes news production less efficient and effective in the long run. There are also dilemmas if reader analytics show demographic differences of engagement by gender, age, ethnic background, education, and income. It has been shown that a slight change in a headline, for example, can increase by an order of magnitude how many people read it. But it is also possible that tweaking writing for greater impact would reinforce the herd mentality that journalism scholars recognized well before the web. By 2016, journalists and readers alike believed that social media were endangering the credibility of all news thanks to the efficiency of propagating stories. Fake information is hardly a new issue. It even predates American independence. Paul Revere's famous engraving of the Boston Massacre of 1770 was an inflammatory and inaccurate version of the actual events, today's scholars believe, despite its inclusion in countless U.S. history textbooks. And it was just this exaggeration of the bloodshed and one-sided portrayal of British guilt that helped make the print so popular. Another American icon, Horatio Alger, inadvertently advanced false facts by instructing his sister to burn his letters, fearing exposure of his homosexuality. As a young man, he had left the ministry and Massachusetts for New York following a child abuse scandal. Alger's first biographer, Herbert R. Mays, confessed late in life that he had fabricated the missing information in his 1928 study. Meanwhile, its facts had made their way even into the first edition of the August Dictionary of American Biography. In the second edition, Alger's definitive academic biographer, Gary Scharnhorst, notes ruefully that three later lives of Alger were based on Mays's book, and that so are countless other reference sources. The Revere and Mays works confirm for the print age what prevails on the web. People accepted what they wanted to believe, whether the bloodthirstiness of British troops or, at the peak of debunking, the personal failure of an apostle of success. What is different is the web's efficiency at accelerating the spread of fabrications. The computer scientist Emilio Ferrara has examined the prevalence of fictitious personas supported in turn by their own fake followers, some of them created by governments and politicians. The July 2016 referendum on the United Kingdom's membership in the European Union showed how prominent automated social media posts had become and how potentially confusing they were for journalists trying to follow and measure public sentiment. Researchers have discovered a strong influence of automated programs, bots, retweeting both Leave and Remain messages in the June 2016 Brexit referendum on the UK's future in the European Union. A third of all Twitter messages, 500,000, came from only 1% of the accounts, many of them probably automated, with Leave messages retweeted 3 times as often as Remain. Another study revealed that of the 200 most active retweeters, 90% were bot accounts. The prevalence of bots is due to the efficiency of social media in opening new accounts and accepting and diffusing messages without charge. Bots don't appear to have changed the outcome of the referendum. If an echo chamber effect existed on Facebook concerning the issue, preventing members from seeing posts by the other side, it did not stop people from seeing the posts of pro-Brexit politicians. Britain's tabloid press, still strong in the nation's declining industrial areas, may have had more influence on the outcome of the referendum. Likewise, there is no clear evidence that fabricated stories influenced the outcome of the US 2016 election decisively. One economic study suggests that while people follow the well-known principle of confirmation bias in choosing and evaluating news, fewer than 10% are ready to believe anything supporting their position. The real issue is not that sinister forces are distorting voters' choices, at least not through false stories propagated through social media. The economists who studied fake news found that a false story would have to be as powerful as 36 television commercials to have made a difference in the presidential campaigns. Instead, it is that made-up stories are like invasive species choking off native wildlife. In a healthier circulation and advertising environment, they would be mere nuisances, but under stressed conditions they can be a serious threat. Paul Horner, a professional fake news writer, claimed to the Washington Post in November 2016 that his inventions had put Donald Trump over the top. That assertion may be the biggest fake news of all, but consider the advertising budgets that shady sites absorb through the efficiency of ad-serving programs. Horner alone has boasted of making $10,000 a month, and many other fake sites clear $5,000. Many Eastern European fake news purveyors also were attracted not necessarily by the personality or policies of Donald Trump, but by his followers' appetite for partisan fantasies. It's likely that many enthusiasts on both sides of the election savored negative stories about the other as satire rather than as literal truth, more as The Onion than as a publication of record. Indeed, some Onion satires have been taken literally by newcomers to the site. The controversy over fake news is rooted in the growth of extreme partisanship in the United States since the 1990s, a trend clearly connected with the rise of talk radio and cable television, but still not understood. That should not be surprising. Separating causes from effects in landmark elections and distinguishing the relative weight of issues can take decades of study at the intersection of political science, economics, sociology, and history. There is already evidence, however, that voters who retransmit stories about Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump may see them as provocation, trolling, as fictions that reveal a deeper truth about the opposition's character. For example, birtherism and rumors of Obama's secret Muslim faith may be rooted not at all in Obama's African ancestry or Arabic middle name, but in his upbringing in Indonesia, in the cool self-control he learned as a child in Java, a trait that served him well politically, but that unsympathetic voters might consider alien. Fake news may belong more to the study of folklore and urban legends than to the dark arts of propaganda and disinformation. By early 2017, as Wired magazine concluded, Donald Trump and his spokespeople were charging Democrats with fake news of their own, while sometimes appearing to deny the existence of objective truth in favor of alternative facts. Yet, in the spirit of polarization, Democrats also made questionable claims about the Trump campaign, for example, that it relied on large numbers of bots, many devised by allies of the Russian government or orchestrated by the British big data firm Cambridge Analytica, with ties to Donald Trump's hedge fund billionaire supporter and computer scientist Robert Mercer. The Washington Post showed how exaggerated these fears have been. Donald Trump's Twitter account has fewer false followers than those of Barack Obama or indeed the Post itself. Cambridge Analytica's prowess also probably falls short of progressives' suspicions. It worked no wonders for its original Republican presidential campaign client, Senator Ted Cruz. Another skeptic, the Bloomberg News correspondent Leonid Bershitsky, noted that Cambridge Analytica's algorithm had flooded him with solicitations for donations, although it is public knowledge that Bershitsky is a Russian citizen disqualified from contributing. A more likely technological explanation of the presidential outcome in 2016 was the Achilles heel of the big data used by Hillary Clinton's campaign. In September, the online magazine Politico profiled Clinton's big data guru, director of analytics, Ilan Kriegel, whom colleagues credited with bringing new efficiency to identifying key voters and the channels for reaching them. The article mocked Donald Trump for slighting the value of data and quoted a Republican data analyst's worries about his party being left in the dust. In retrospect, the confidence of Clinton campaign manager Robbie Mook in Kriegel's model, along with personal conflicts in the staff, was a possibly fatal weak point. The software, Ada, could generate hundreds of thousands of simulations, but according to a computer scientist who studied the program, it was flawed by assumptions built into it by Kriegel and his staff, biases that kept it from countering a loss of support. The campaign's real problem may have been that the data weren't big enough, that the campaign was not getting up-to-date polling information that might have revealed loss of support in time for the outreach that Clinton supporters in Michigan had been urging on her data-driven Brooklyn headquarters. The crisis of truth, though, goes beyond politics and even the economic consequences of dilution of support for quality journalism of all persuasions. It is, as the political economist William Davies has argued, the analysis of enormous data sets itself that has challenged the classical 19th century statistical analysis that has been a foundation of factuality. Many citizens no longer believe in the integrity or accuracy of government figures. There are important political and social trends behind this suspicion, and sometimes real flaws in formulating questions and gathering data. But the existence of vast, automatically generated and privately owned and analyzed records of human behavior and attitudes is playing a growing part. Sentiment analysis, deducing consumer and political attitudes from people's online language, is starting to take the place of the data that were generally accepted and fought over by progressives and conservatives alike. The success of newspapers will depend not on whether social media sites find a way to detect fraudulent articles. Deception will probably only become more subtle, following Campbell's Law, but whether they can develop their own techniques for drawing conclusions. The greatest threat is not any single rumor or accusation promoted online, but the spread of suspicion and cynicism. The cry of fake news has begun to contaminate all news, as journalists find it difficult to ignore the clamor of social media and thus to help spread ideas even while debunking them. There is no way for algorithms, or indeed for most citizens or journalists, to distinguish lies and half-truths from genuine news. We rely on experts who often depend on other experts. There are also signs that young people may be less able to distinguish the quality of sources online. treating fact-checked media and social media posts indiscriminately. Even more alarmingly, mass skepticism with fake news on its banner risks becoming information nihilism, for which all findings are partisan assertions to be accepted or rejected according to one's identity or politics. The historian of science, Robert Proctor, has coined the word agnotology to define the deliberate spread of ignorance by the tobacco industry and other special interests. If everything online is suspect as being riddled with falsehoods and disinformation, then all news is suspect as biased, even though a solid majority of Americans believes in the principle of fact-checking. It is not surprising that in one survey, only 27% of people who got their news from Facebook trusted it, as opposed to the 75% of readers of print newspapers who trusted them, while other studies showed that half to three-quarters of Americans who had seen false headlines on the web believed them. Skepticism and credulity, once considered opposites, now appear not only to coexist, but perversely to reinforce each other as part of a post-truth syndrome. Because of the Thomas theorem that we have noted, the tendency of perceptions to beget new realities, the fake news controversy has seriously damaged the efficiency of political debate. Mark Penn, Hillary Clinton's former marketing guru, objected in the Wall Street Journal that the proportion of fake news accounts maintained by Russian hackers was too small to have decided anything. Yet before publication of any study, a striking 82% of Democrats and 54% of all persons polled by CNN believed that hacking had swayed the election for Donald Trump. Trump's own digital director, Greg Parscale, has said that electronic targeting of specific voters, actually pioneered by Penn, did decide the contest, but it was his own and his firm's work that did so, without Russian assistance. Meanwhile, the British consultancy Cambridge Analytica would like to share in the credit, and has attracted some of the blame as well. The result of such claims and counterclaims is that politics is increasingly perceived as a form of manipulative electronic sport among technical wire pullers, with voters as pawns rather than as rational actors. Perhaps distrust of all news rather than the election of Donald Trump was the real goal of foreign interference. It's possible that newspapers, chastised by critics for oligopoly, complacency, and superficiality, even in their financial heyday, may yet be shocked into a new titanium, if not a golden age. The New York Times has published its own roadmap for such a transformation. But nothing can replace the lost state and local reporting that, as the crusading reporter turned academic press critic Ben Bagdikian noted, are essential to accurate information on public officials in America. Especially because of losses at these levels, New York City employment has been stable, and staffs in Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles have actually increased. From 2007 to 2015 alone, the number of full-time U.S. journalists at daily papers dropped over 40%, from 55,000 to 32,900. It is true that the growth of jobs in digital-only publications from 3,410 in 2005 to 10,580 in 2015 has partly offset the decline. Yet this once promising sector has been stagnant since 2013. Magazines have faced a different challenge from the efficiency of web distribution and platform advertising. According to the 2016 Pew Media Report, circulation of publications it classifies as news magazines has been remarkably stable, considering the competition from the explosion of online video and other new media. This repeats the experience of magazines during the rise of television from the 1950s through the 1970s. Television's share of advertising revenue grew rapidly. It was almost double that of magazines by 1960, nearly triple by 1970, and almost quadruple by 1982. yet magazine advertising continued to increase. Magazines survived the rise of television because of their ability to build both circulation and advertising on the specific backgrounds and interests of readers. Time magazine could point to its popularity among frequent flyers, for example. It even printed a special edition for them, as it did for the highest income households and for women subscribers. Magazines have always been more efficient advertising buys, in this sense, than non-financial newspapers. Like newspapers, magazines adapted to the web by publishing online editions with their own advertising stream. As blogs flourished in the first decade of the 21st century, the genre faced technological and financial realities. Search engines and the linking structure of the web directed a large share of traffic to a relatively small number of blogs, some of which developed into profitable digital publications. Others were bought by conventional media and platform companies. By 2009, the journalist Benjamin Carlson reported that fully 42% of all blog traffic was going to the top 50 blogs. Thus, the fantasy of the lone web citizen swaying public decisions with incisive commentary all but vanished, but so had the nightmare that a flood of free amateur content would destroy professional writing. The Matthew Effect, named 50 years ago by the sociologist Robert K. Merton after the Gospel Declaration, "For unto every one that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance, but from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath," continues to apply to the power of cumulative advantage expressed through structures of links. The reach of institutional blogs swamped remaining solo bloggers. In fact, bloggers, independent and staff, helped save magazines by attuning them to the Internet age news cycle that had threatened to make monthly and even weekly publication obsolete. The most successful metamorphosis of an old-line publication was probably that of the Atlantic Monthly, which significantly dropped its second name, supplementing the print magazine with a roster of blogs ranging from politics and technology to sports. Having written both for the print Atlantic and for its digital-only blogging platform, I can confirm that readers who cite my Atlantic essays rarely make the distinction between the magazine, print or web, and blogs. They treat everything as part of the magazine, and indeed some blog posts are included by online databases, such as LexisNexis and Factiva, that license text from multiple publications. Some articles occupy a bibliographic no man's land. Benjamin Carlson's piece on blogs, cited previously, appears on the Atlantic website as part of the September 2009 issue, but is absent from that issue's table of contents online and from at least two major library databases, ProQuest and EBSCOhost. Nor did management care much about the distinction at the time. James Bennett, the former editor-in-chief and president, called himself agnostic on the future of the print edition. The Atlantic model has shown that the promise of serious magazines to advertisers, that they can bring their products and services to the attention of affluent and influential readers, is still alive. But the new digital print magazine is still inefficient in the sense that it demands more resources than ever, not just the kind of established thinkers who created the classic print Atlantic Monthly, but a staff of young editor-writers posting frequently on their own, while, at least when I wrote for the magazine, working with outside writers. It takes a ceaseless content generation machine, and one of consistently high quality, to sustain the 27 million unique clicks a month reported by The Atlantic in spring 2016. Paradoxically, The Atlantic and a few other elite publications benefit by cutbacks elsewhere. Between 2009 and 2016, over 1,000 magazines ceased publication. Although about as many new ones were founded, The churn and the continued production of journalism degrees helped create a buyer's market for editor-bloggers who can help draw younger readers through social media. Of course, it is true that high-quality opinion magazines have rarely been profitable and have been heavily subsidized by wealthy owners and think tanks. But the virtual collapse of the New Republic in 2016, after 4 years under the ownership of a Facebook founder, showed that even some of the super-rich no longer believe the prestige of magazine ownership is worth the cost. The Atlantic's traditional rival, Harper's, is still owned by a family foundation and has chosen a strategy inverting the Atlantic's, firmly committed to print and relying on paid subscriptions behind a paywall. While some economists may consider the Atlantic a model of the new efficiency for magazines, despite the high costs of its approach, the point is rather that it is an almost unique survivor of the golden age of the upper-middle-class magazine. It has succeeded by becoming almost a platform in its own right, melding traditional magazine content with the blogging of sites like the Huffington Post and the comprehensiveness of 1990s portals like Yahoo and AOL. The relative paradise of magazine publishing is still fashion, not just because glossy print is still the best showcase for luxury goods, but also because the editorial side of fashion publishing has traditionally aligned itself with leading brands. As fashion marketers have shifted part of their budgets from print to promotion via social media, leading magazine chains have remained their partners. Thus, Condé Nast has been able to offset print advertising losses by offering brands new ways to reach its 100 million online readers and 175 million social media followers. Across all publications, luxury print advertising has fallen by about 8% since 2013 to $2.6 billion, but the digital sector has grown by 63% to slightly over $1 billion. This success just underlines the hardships faced by other categories of magazines. The decades-old norm of a wall of separation between editorial and advertising departments, between church and state, as it is often called, has been crumbling. Over two-thirds of magazine publishers responding to a survey now use their own editorial staff to create special features, native advertising for sponsors, even the New York Times. Thus, as an online trade publication put it, most journalists may now be part-time copywriters. But outside the luxury and fashion market, this expedient is bringing its own problems, especially reader confusion on the boundary between editorial and advertising material, possibly at the cost of readers' trust. The one bright spot in the periodical advertising scene is the rise of glossy magazine supplements to newspapers like the Wall Street Journal and Financial Times. In August 2017, despite an overall 7% decline in advertising of its parent News Corp, the Wall Street Journal magazine reported an increase of 5% in both pages and revenue, an all-time high. In autumn 2017, the resignations and retirements of several prominent magazine editors prompted a new wave of foreboding in the industry, and New York Times media correspondents contrasted their departures and the imperiled heritage of the genre with the announcement of Time Inc.'s new cute animal video series. The sale of Time Inc. to Meredith Corporation in November 2017 confirmed many fears. A publishing optimist might look, however, at the same events and recall that nearly all magazine paradigms follow cycles. Henry Luce founded Life magazine in the Depression by buying the name of a tired monthly that had prospered in the Roaring Twenties. Vanity Fair, discontinued by Condé Nast as an independent publication in 1935, was revived in the 1980s by S.I. Newhouse Jr. Evidence abroad suggests that there are still unfilled niches in the U.S. In the U.K., which has a higher percentage of homes with broadband internet than the U.S. does, paper editions of both serious and satirical magazines continue to prosper. Private Eye circulation was almost at a new peak in summer 2017. Looking at newspapers and magazines together, the positive and negative effects of extreme efficiency are clear. It's more efficient to get and read news. I have over a dozen newspaper and magazine apps on my iPhone, and also get feeds from publications via Twitter. Some critics have charged that the web has created echo chambers, in which polarized publics see only the news that fits their political outlooks. But it's not clear that the real problem is the suppression of intellectual diversity. Even the arch-skeptic Evgeny Morozov has asserted in a review of Eli Pariser's The Filter Bubble that personalization can actually improve serendipity. This is a difficult proposition to prove or disprove, especially, as Morozov notes, given Louis Pasteur's dictum of chance favoring the prepared mind. Some people, regardless of formal education, are probably more open to serendipitous discovery than others. There is at least evidence that polarization is not mainly the result of ignorance of opposing views. A study of web use by young adults conducted by the National Opinion Research Center of the University of Chicago revealed that the great majority drew on news from a variety of sources, regardless of their own preferences. Other critics of the web note the bias of algorithms. Not only conservatives, who suspect Facebook of slighting their viewpoints, but also progressives who detect censorship by algorithm. It is true that the makers of the dominant mobile operating systems, Apple, iOS, and Google, Android, have suppressed apps without an effective right of appeal. Sometimes their targets are apps inimical to their interests. For example, attacks on working conditions in factories making a company's smartphones. The main problem, however, is that algorithms are written neither to advance a political outlook nor to establish the truth, but to maximize traffic and advertising revenue for the platform company. The sociologist of computing, Zeynep Tufekci, has described them as billions of semi-savant mini-Frankensteins, spitting out answers here and there to questions we can't judge just by numbers, all under the cloak of objectivity and science. This sounds terrible, but is it really any worse than often equally arbitrary decisions made by editors at the peak of the print era? In fact, following the rise of ultranationalism and racism in the 2016 election and thereafter, many believe that algorithms should be used to curb the spread of online hate speech. The underlying problem may be that radical positions right and left, by inciting user engagement pro and con, tend to suppress balanced ones. In building traffic, moderation may be no virtue and extremism no vice, as Barry Goldwater prophetically put it. The second problem is that instead of replacing the human editor, social media algorithms interpose another layer between the editor and the reader, an opaque process, a black box. Publishers also must face the expense of developing usable apps for two platforms, getting them approved by the platform companies, and revising them with new operating system releases, in addition to maintaining the desktop versions of their publications, which also must be usable by both desktop and mobile readers. Book publishers also need technically proficient staff members to format data for Amazon and the few remaining bookstore chains. In fact, as the writer Craig Lambert has argued, many of the gains of high technology have come through outsourcing services to the user that were once provided for no additional charge by the seller's own employees. Shadow work, to use a phrase coined by the philosopher Ivan Illich. What is convenient for users can be the opposite for firms that have no choice but to conform. What about information sources that are not like most newspapers and general interest magazines, dependent on advertisers. Their editors don't have the burden of working around the algorithms of the platform oligarchs. Yet even in these areas of cultural production, the search for efficiency leads to inefficient use of at least some kinds of important information. As noted earlier in this chapter, the Google PageRank algorithm was a populist adaptation of an elitist surveillance technique. Meanwhile, researchers in the humanities and social sciences, as well as the natural sciences, have acquired access to a stunning range of sources from the earliest days of print, thanks to commercial and not-for-profit scanning and digitization projects. Formerly in the 1990s, there was often a gap between the latest electronic issues of a journal and print copies of back volumes that might have to be summoned from libraries' remote storage, or still worse, be available only in microfilm. The ability of end users to search through decades of writing promised to correct much of readers' myopia and their unfortunate tendency to repeat or rediscover older work. Despite the common view that science advances so rapidly that older literature becomes obsolete, researchers actually are keenly interested in it. Many 19th-century books, especially those by giants like Charles Darwin and James Clerk Maxwell, are still revered. Information scientists have even identified a category of older article called Sleeping Beauties, initially obscure, that are rediscovered and frequently cited. Some were the work of people almost unknown to their contemporaries. Gregor Mendel's 1866 paper on the genetics of peas, in a provincial Moravian journal, may not have been quite as obscure on publication as historians once thought, but it had to wait decades for its real impact. Even the greatest minds are not immune. One of Albert Einstein's papers, written after he had received the Nobel Prize, co-authored with Boris Podolsky and Nathan Rosen in 1935, took decades to be cited widely. The information scientist Alessandro Flamini and his colleagues have found numerous such examples in a study of more than 22 million individual papers. Medical knowledge is especially oblivion-prone. The physician and writer Oliver Sacks cited a number of cases from his own practice, including geometric patterns in the headaches of his patients when he was a young neurologist. While undocumented in 1960s textbooks, these illusions had been described by forgotten writers 100 years earlier in forgotten books and journals. Neglected social science papers, too, may have great latent merit. One management theorist, Craig Pritchard, reviewed 8 entirely uncited papers in the contemporary journal Organization, and discovered that while there were sociological explanations for their neglect, at least some of them had potentially valuable insights on major topics, like pay disparity between white and African American workers. There may actually be serendipitous value in some of the most neglected papers, it appears. Alongside conventional citation analysis, we might investigate whether there are ways to identify papers that deserve another look. 19th and early 20th century journals and books now in the public domain might have hidden gems of observations and theories. Data mining software, already used in current science, might be applied to the older literature as well as to more recent studies. Computer scientists, recognizing that nearly a quarter of major scientific discoveries have relied on some form of apparently chance discovery, have been studying how to seek out and recommend work that might not be apparent in conventional literature searches. The Semantic Scholar Program of the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence in Seattle, Washington, is the best-known initiative, though I have found its results inferior to those of Google Scholar, the search engine's academic interface. The new efficiency of search and the extension of citation indexing to older papers would have suggested more attention to older work. Easy discovery should broaden search horizons, but the opposite has been the case. After studying citation patterns in 35 million articles in a variety of scientific fields from 1945 to 2005, the sociologist James Evans found that researchers were actually paying more attention to fewer papers overall and generally to the more recent ones. This seems unlikely and was questioned by some other scholars of scientific influence, but Evans was unconvinced by their objections. And the social structure of scientific influence helps explain the paradox. When scientists had to pore over print journals, there was no convenient way to judge the relative importance of papers, so past literature was cited more broadly. Electronic publication did put older and newer research on a more equal footing, but it also made it easier for scientists to discover which papers were most popular with their colleagues and to align themselves with trends. That is not necessarily good for scientific creativity, Evans cautioned. Agreement may not be a measure of truth or importance. Electronic journals accelerate consensus by amplifying tiny differences in quality. The result may be that promising results and concepts that are not taken up rapidly by the community will fade from its consciousness. Electronic links may promote the winner-take-all phenomenon that the economists Philip Cook and Robert H. Frank noticed in the broader society in the 1990s. Relatively primitive indexing by titles and authors, mainly in core journals, actually helped integrate knowledge, a positive, unintended consequence of inefficiency. Print browsing may have been serendipitous, encouraging more attention to productive byways. Scientific fashions did not, of course, start with electronic publication. The rise of big science and competition for government and foundation grants in the post-war era put a premium on appearing to be on the cutting edge. The idea of the wisdom of crowds, behavioral economists remind us, refers to the value of combining independent judgments, for example, of the number of jelly beans in a jar. The effect disappears when people confer and groupthink sets in. There are powerful social forces that support joining a consensus, even though, thanks to the proliferation of journals and self-publishing, it is easier than ever to share a novel idea. In spite of, or because of this ease of access, the rise of the web has highlighted the importance of reputation, and there is much less reputational risk in supporting a popular idea than an unpopular one. There is relatively little stigma if most others make the same mistake. Conversely, there are risks in attacking the work of influential figures supported by major grants and well-staffed laboratories. Following the herd is a short-term efficient strategy for building an individual reputation, but a behavior that makes science less efficient at discovery in the long run. Social scientists offer other insights on the effect of new publication patterns and measurement technologies on science itself. Sociologists of science have shown how misleading citation analysis can be if it is limited to conventional raw data. On the most elementary level, older papers obviously have had more time to gather citations, so comparisons should be made among publications from the same year. But journals also have different policies that in turn affect the citation rates of their papers without any necessary relationship to their quality. The greatest challenge may be that short-term citation rates, those with the greatest impact on young scientists' careers, may not necessarily reflect the long-term impact of work on the evolution of a discipline. One frontier of the quantitative analysis of scientific influence is the study of the full text of articles and books as well as references. Yet it is not clear that any of these methods can address the cumulative advantage promoted by measurement itself. The price of greater sophistication is the added time needed to master the latest measurement techniques, time that may present an opportunity cost to researcher administrators in their actual work. Recent research has also confirmed that bad publicity can be good for citations. Work, possibly of low quality, can be rated highly if it leads to rebuttals in comments rather than to indifference. Just as Daniel Boorstin defined a celebrity as someone well known for being well known, papers can also gain self-perpetuating fame without necessarily having exceptional merit. In the Royal Society journal Impact, the physicist and complex systems researcher Matyaj Perch has found that some papers are cited just because they have been cited elsewhere so often. In fact, even in searching for articles critical of cumulative advantage, it is almost impossible to avoid giving preference to those papers that Google or Google Scholar or another resource using a search algorithm derived from Google's PageRank principle puts at the top of the list. Citation patterns show the conflict of two kinds of efficiency. Scientific and technological studies, like those underlying electronic data storage and retrieval, make life more efficient. But real innovation often cannot happen efficiently. While the importance of failure captivates popular science and inspiration writing alike, real setbacks can be hard to overcome, as I suggested when discussing survivor bias in the preface. Many wealthy Silicon Valley entrepreneurs have been associated with a failed business at one point, yet the founders of Microsoft, Amazon, Google, and Facebook all became wealthy as young men, and Steve Jobs's exile from Apple was relatively brief. But at least venture capitalists have open minds. The rules of peer review in science are failure-averse, if only because most research communities have grown more rapidly than grant support. Many elite scientists are dismayed. The Nobel laureate biochemist Roger Kornberg has protested, "In the present climate especially, the funding decisions are ultra-conservative. If the work that you propose to do isn't virtually certain of success, then it won't be funded. And of course, the kind of work that we would most like to see take place, which is groundbreaking and innovative, lies at the other extreme." The physics Nobelist Peter Higgs has doubted he would be considered productive enough to get funding today. More frequent and shorter papers have become the norm. Technological efficiency does not determine the pattern recognized by James Evans, but does help to amplify it. The efficiency of following links among scientific papers has also affected the behavior of journal publishers and academic administrators, as well as of individual researchers. One of the innovations of Eugene Garfield's Institute for Scientific Information was the introduction of a measure of the average number of citations of articles published in each journal, the so-called impact factor. It's an apparently simple formula, a division of the number of citations by the number of qualifying papers published in a journal. Garfield never meant it to be the principal measure of a journal's quality. Citation practices vary across fields. Mathematics papers are cited much less often than biology papers, for example. But once the metric was available, deans, department heads, senior administrators, and many government agencies began to interpret it as a journal's worth. Some governments pay many thousands of dollars in additional support when their scientists appear in publications like Nature, Science, and Cell. Journal editors, in turn, adjusted their mix of papers to favor those by authors with strong records of citation by others. Just as electronic availability of journals tended to narrow research to the most popular lines, impact measurement also rewards the choice of already popular approaches. Information technology, far from equalizing opportunities, as many enthusiasts of the 1990s predicted, has privileged the more established laboratories, universities, and publishers. Impact measurement also has risks for quality itself. Higher impact journals have higher rates of retraction, in some cases after discovery of fraud. There is also an unintended consequence of the impact factor. It magnifies the value of striking data. The more unexpected the results, the more likely a paper is to be published in a high-impact journal, enhancing a researcher's chances for promotion and further funding. In addition to the well-known cases of fraud, there have been a growing number of retractions when replication of results by other scientists has failed. We will consider the effects of this trend in medicine in Chapter 5. It is much more common for later experiments to support the original paper more weakly. This tendency is known as the decline effect. There is usually no deliberate deception. There are legitimate reasons for discarding data from early runs and publishing when results are clear-cut. Prestigious journals, eager for citations to keep up their rank, also are looking for results that will be widely cited. They are less likely to publish replication studies. Most papers are never replicated at all. Campbell's law thus brings scientists and journal editors into a feedback loop that rewards fast and striking results that may or may not hold up. Another problem of scientific efficiency emerges from Evans's work. Some critics questioned Evans's focus on non-conforming science. They ask whether most progress isn't the result of incremental knowledge rather than revolutionary ideas. Evans made a significant point in reply. Electronic tools take researchers to the end results of others' work, but they do not readily access vital underlying data, such as the billion molecular interactions studied in 25 years of DNA research. Electronic search, he concluded, actually accelerates the forgetting of essential data. The situation is probably even more serious than Evans thought. A few years after his paper was published, a study of data of 516 ecology papers published between 1991 and 2011 revealed that 80% of data was unavailable after two decades. It is true that this was a period of unusually rapid change in hardware, zip drives, software, Lotus 1-2-3, and operating systems. But while formats may be more stable now, the efficiency of acquiring data in many fields has created new problems. The Large Hadron Collider at CERN produces 700 megabytes of data each second, according to an article by the philosopher and policy scholar Mark Sagoff. The challenge is most acute in genomics, in which new sequencing technology reduced the cost per megabyte from $1,000 in 2008 to only 10 cents in 2012, one of the most striking accomplishments of technological efficiency in history. The data generated by the latest genetic paradigm, the study of the body's bacteria as part of an internal ecosystem, will be staggering. The catch is that the efficiency of storage takes over a year to double. Cheap big data need media that are becoming relatively costlier, not to mention the salaries of skilled technicians who ensure the data's integrity and eventually transfer it to new hardware. There are a number of proposals, and some journals have clear policies on availability of published authors' data, but there is no solution in sight. Encoding information in DNA strands has been one of the most intriguing alternatives, but at $3,500 per megabyte, it is unlikely to be economically viable soon. Meanwhile, an IBM study has estimated that 90% of the world's electronic data has been added in the past 2 years. Thus, inflation in the absolute storage cost is likely to outstrip near-term reductions in storage costs, even if Moore's law continues to apply. The data tsunami, as it is often called, reveals a paradox of efficiency in the age of big data. It is more efficient for scientists to gather massive data sets and interpret them later than to design experiments around a hoped-for outcome, hypothesis-free science, or discovery science, as it has been called. The concept is still debated. Some epidemiologists, for example, have tried to use the frequency of searches and users' locations to track infectious disease. In 2014, the economics columnist Tim Harford, reviewing the failure of Google Flu Trends to predict the spread of influenza more accurately,